Good morning, I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wilderness, and special places. From the beaches, to the mountains, to the deserts, this is Tree Huggers International. Be careful, and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. Shortly after the collapse of BP's Deepwater Horizon oil platform in April of 2010, and the beginning of what would become the worst environmental disaster in the Gulf of Mexico and the largest maritime oil spill in history, Jared Criscuolo and Christian Gustafson of Below the Surface paid a visit to the Gulf Coast to see for themselves what was going on. The stories they brought back and featured on this show of devastated fishing economies and ruined marshlands was tragic. Sadly, little has been learned or done to change drilling conditions in the Gulf of Mexico since then. Meanwhile, the long cleanup continues, as does the rebuilding of the Gulf Coast economy. Since then, Jared and Christian have continued growing Below the Surface and bringing attention to the plight of America's waterways. They've also been busy developing and applying new software applications which will help with better mapping and charting of waterways, as well as reveal new opportunities for river conservation and local involvement through Below the Surface's Riverview Project. And to top it all off, Jared and Christian were named Outside Magazine's Readers of the Year for 2012, giving them a chance to blog for Outside throughout the year and raise even more awareness about Below the Surface and the Riverview Project as they continue their coast-to-coast exploration of America's waterways. Jared, Christian, welcome back to Tree Huggers International. It is great to have the two of you here. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tommy. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tommy. We're excited to be here.
I want to spend some time talking about the evolution of the Riverview Project, but let's take a step back and just go over some of the principles of Below the Surface once again, and the mission and how you two came together. You want to start with that, Jared?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having us, Tommy. So Below the Surface is a nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to the exploration of and education about the issues surrounding water. We started out on rivers, paddling, exploring, seeing what was going on. I was with the Surf Rider Foundation when we started. Christian was doing a paddle down the Mississippi River and some research at UCSD through an independent study there. We came together after his paddle and decided to move things forward, so we started looking at different opportunities to explore different rivers throughout America, the impact of those rivers on the coastline, and just gather photos and video of that. And we've kind of grown and evolved over the years as we've experienced different, you know, natural disasters and not-so-natural disasters. As we've seen things along the way, we've worked with different businesses, agencies, other nonprofit organizations, academic institutions, to really get a better, clearer idea of the issues impacting our waterways. And from there, we've developed a platform that we're using to help educate people, engage them in the expeditionary side of what we did, but also use that as a tool to get more advocacy and activism amongst the population to try to push for cleaner rivers, better policy for dealing with our waterways.
Now, Jared, you're from New England originally, and Christian, you're from Chicago. Being from some different parts of the country, from Southern California, did you feel that there was a niche, or rather, did you feel that America's waterways in general weren't quite getting this level of advocacy directed to them?
Absolutely. And really, surfing taught both of us the value of river conservation and water conservation, particularly looking upstream. Growing up in the Midwest, paddling on the rivers, you realize that this water is going somewhere, but you don't necessarily see the end result. Being out here in San Diego surfing, the standard is you can't or you shouldn't go in the water 72 hours after a rainstorm. So that's a real serious issue, and it's to be taken seriously because we have both experienced illness, whether it's ear infections, throat infections, or actually know people that have gotten either MRSA or hepatitis A or other serious illnesses from surfing in polluted water.
Jared, was that the same in New England? Because you grew up in Connecticut, and when you went surfing there, was that 72-hour adage there as well after it rained?
That wasn't an issue. I started surfing when I was about 15 years old with friends of mine. We were just looking for something different to do. We all ski raced and mountain bike raced together and wanted an alternative. So we'd make the drive out to Rhode Island and paddle out. The best time to surf in New England is in the fall during the hurricane season, and that usually had, you know, a fairly significant rain episode that came along with it. I grew up with the expectation that you can surf after or during a rainstorm, and it wasn't an issue. One thing that I've subsequently learned is that the coastline of New England is a lot different than here. We have marshes. We have, you know, sort of a natural buffer zone that absorbs a lot of the pollution, the brake dust runoff, all the stuff that comes and washes off the streets and would otherwise enter the watershed. But when I moved out here, that's what really set this whole thing off. And Christian had similar experiences as well, where I paddled out the first week that I got to San Diego, and I was in bed for a week with a litany of different symptoms, but I came to find out that it was largely caused because I went surfing after a rainstorm, and it was after a first flush event here in San Diego.
So you took this experience from surfing and you began applying it far, far upstream to all of the rivers.
Absolutely. And it was actually because of surfing that led me to get a job. I was working as a surf instructor for UCSD Recreation when I was doing my undergrad there. We taught all of our lessons right out front of Scripps Institution of Oceanography. For 2 years, I was working, you know, basically on the beach at Scripps, teaching these lessons and learning things just from casual interaction with professors and students and getting to know the campus more. And over the years, I actually ended up doing an independent study there. And that led us to basically launching the expedition that formed the foundation for our organization Below the Surface.
And so by the time that the oil spill happened in 2010, you guys had already been to some areas of the Gulf Coast. You'd seen some of the waterways there. And so when you went there to see what had happened, you were already familiar with the area.
Yeah, and it was strange because we had just launched an expedition called Gaining Ground down the Atchafalaya River, which is a distributary of the Mississippi. It flows a more natural course through the center of Louisiana. It's actually the largest marsh, largest wetland in the country. This was in February. We met with all these different people from the Audubon, from Riverkeeper, from Atchafalaya Basin Keeper, from LSU, and we had a great expedition, learned a lot about the Mississippi River system, learned a lot about coastal ecology, because the Atchafalaya has the only two growing deltas in the south. And then, boom, 2 months later, this disaster happens, and we wanted to plug back in and pick back up where we left off.
Have you been in touch with some of your acquaintances and friends down there since then?
Absolutely. And I actually, it led me to my master's work, which I ended up doing at Scripps.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Riverview Project. This is introducing some technology and some very real-world technology applications into exploring waterways, right?
Yeah, exactly. Christian mentioned the expedition that we did on the Atchafalaya River Gaining Ground in the beginning of 2010. And it was right around that time that we had been, you know, prior to that expedition, during it and after, we had been taking a lot of the images, the video, the photographs. Christian had created an educational plan called the 90-Day Plan. And we took all those different things through one of our friends and advisors and built out Google Maps with that information. So we had started visualizing and kind of tying everything together throughout the watershed, these maps of images of rivers that we had taken underway. At the same time, we were starting to look at EPA's data about river quality, the U.S. Geological Survey stream gauge stations on water quality, and we were plugging that into Google Maps in different ways just to try to visualize what was going on rivers and what we were seeing along the way. Christian and I were driving around after the Gaining Ground expedition talking about the next steps. You know, we'd done all these great expeditions, we'd seen a lot, but we wanted to take it a level further. We were trying to figure out how do we get out in front of as many people as possible. And at the time, the working theory was, well, if we had a TV show,
right,
we could use that as an advocacy tool. But we realized we did all this work with Google, and we're driving around, and I looked at Christian, and I said, what if we made Street View for rivers? And he goes, yeah, that makes sense. So we went back and forth on that in the conversation for a while, and we decided that Riverview is what we would call it, and it would be a really cool tool. And it was just sort of out there. We started telling people about it. The more people we told about it, the more excitement and enthusiasm we got on it. So this sort of evolved throughout 2010 and 2011, and a lot of things happened along the way that validated the concept and idea. And now we're at this point where we've built a bunch of partnerships and we're moving forward with the project.
Now, you've gone to Google with all this information and said, look what we're doing with this. And had anyone at Google seen anything like this before? Had they? Because they're pretty sharp folks. Had they thought of this before?
We had a call with the director of the Developer Relations Department. And basically, that department is set up to share Google's software applications and packages with outside developers that are working on various projects. So we spoke to this guy and basically pitched him on the idea and the concept. And his response was, kudos to you guys for thinking this. I've never heard of anything quite like it before.
Did he have some ideas for applications for it beyond conservation needs?
He didn't have anything in particular that he shared. He really liked the idea, and he said, the way I can help you guys is to put you in touch with his lead developer of Google Earth and Google Maps. So we actually, after a year and a half of trying to get in touch with someone at Google, we were able to go directly to the headquarters in Mountain View, sit down with one of the gentlemen there and walk through the whole process. We ended up spending about 3 hours at the place, went to lunch with them, saw the whole Google complex, which in and of itself is it's a edifice of inspiration. We kind of figured out what we could use, what would be relevant to building this. And they gave us access, and this is publicly available information, but they still kind of passed off access to us to Street View's code. So now we can take the demo map that we have, migrate it from Bing to Google, and actually use the navigation tools that people expect when they see Street View.
Now tell me how the USGS got involved, because when people think of the U.S. Geological Survey, I don't really necessarily think of flowcharts for rivers. You're thinking in terms of geologic things, earthquakes and volcanoes.
The USGS thing was something that Christian and I had talked about for quite some time. We said, oh, we've got to find an agency, get in touch with them and engage with them, and that'll make this happen. You know, and it really seemed to be, in our minds, sort of the panacea of Riverview. Neither one of us had any contacts. I mean, both of us are fairly personal people. We like to get a direct connection. You know, we find that that's usually the best way to get something to happen. Christian's independent study is a testament to that. You know, he made a personal connection with Paul Dayton, and that really launched things off, you know, for him on the first expedition. So we had been looking for that. We couldn't find that direct contact with someone. So I just went to the USGS website one day at work. I was getting frustrated with the fact that we weren't making any momentum. It had been 13 or 14 months, and I just sent in a general email. Within 3 hours, I was getting emails from the assistant for the director of water information in Reston, Virginia. And then I got an email from the director herself. And then a week later, she had me in touch with this guy, Sandy Williamson, who had a similar idea, but it was more of a crowdsourced version. He lives in Tacoma, Washington. It turns out his daughter and son-in-law live in Vista here in San Diego. And within a week of this inbound email, totally blind to USGS's general website, I was sitting in Oceanside with this guy, Sandy, talking about Riverview and Streamview. And it turns out that we had almost the exact same idea in the beginning of 2010, but just had different approaches to doing it.
USGS must have been, I think, thrilled to have something like this brought to them. So were they just stoked to get something like this? Was it something that they had ever considered?
It definitely seemed like it sparked something with them. And just like with a lot of other data sets and research, it's not that we don't have the information. It's that it's not necessarily available or even interesting for the public.
And so now you've got USGS on board as a partner with this, correct?
Yeah, basically what happened was after that initial email and that conversation with Sandy, we set up a series of conference calls with people ranging from the director of the Office of Water Information, Catherine, through different science centers in the country. So the USGS has their main headquarters in Virginia, but they're decentralized with water science centers throughout the country. So we've got about five core people that we've been having conference calls with anywhere from once a month to every couple of weeks. We signed a collaborative agreement with them, which basically commits that we'll bring forth the technology, the software, everything that we need, the camera equipment and the resources to film this and cut the website out of it. They'll give us access to boats, staff time, science information, all the resources that we need. So basically we pick up a phone, call someone in Nebraska, say we want to do a river in Nebraska, we want to come film the Platte, and boom, we're set up with the local science center and they help us coordinate everything on the ground. They actually recently flew me back to Washington, D.C. I gave a presentation at two separate national meetings they had, one to their Information Technology Advisory Committee and one to the senior staff of the water group there. So they're fully engaged, they're extremely excited about this. And they're helping us in a lot of ways, both from validating the idea all the way on up to introducing us to the different science centers and serving as a resource to access different groups that are interested in potentially funding the project.
Now, how did the Nature Conservancy get on board of this? Because you're working with a gentleman who works out of their, is it a field office in Chico?
Yeah, when we first had the idea, we had applied for a grant with Cliff Bar to go up to the Sacramento River. Just for a little back end on this, Christian and I did an expedition down the Sacramento River in 2009, basically paddled source to sea. The expedition was called Spring to Sand Trap, and the idea was that we would trace water from the source in Northern California at the spring all the way down to the sand traps of the golf courses in Southern California. We went back up there with a kayak and just did a series of short paddles, and this is the point where we were sort of exploring what Riverview might look like. We were calling it charting the course at the time, and the idea was just to go out and sort of set the parameters on what we would do. So we were taking pictures of the USGS's stream gauge stations. Through the contacts that we developed up there in 2009, I got put in touch with a guy named Ryan Luster, who's a program director in the Chico, California office for the Nature Conservancy. And they've got a really cool program going on there. But basically what we did was we walked in, presented the idea, and said, what do you think of this? And he proceeded to tell us about a project that they have where they're buying up 33,000 acres of riparian corridor, so basically farmland that abuts the Sacramento River. And the idea is they want to reinstitute a cottonwood forest along the side of the river, which will help improve biodiversity. It'll help stabilize the banks there, which is a major issue. It'll help revitalize various animal populations from, you know, small insects all the way on up to birds and larger predators. A major problem in the Central Valley is that a lot of the produce in this country, almost two-thirds, comes from the Central Valley of California, which is where the Sacramento River runs through. There was a point a few years back where there was a collapse in the bee population. Because of that, crops couldn't be pollinated, and the ag industry up there had to import bees from Canada in order to make sure that there wasn't a crop collapse that year. So the work that the Nature Conservancy is doing is extremely important in order to ensure the viability, not just the economic viability, but to ensure the health of the ecosystem up there. They're about 18,000 acres into their 33,000 acre goal, and I think it's a project that's slated to be wrapped up in 2015. So they're doing some incredible work. But when we pitched the idea of Riverview, Ryan suggested that it would be really valuable for him to be able to take the maps of areas that had been purchased and repopulated with cottonwoods and compare that with areas that hadn't been, because it's just a great visual tool. It's a 360-degree image, just like Street View, that shows that area and shows what's happening and what changes along the way. And we've had a lot of similar conversations to that. Every group that we go to, we went on a trip, a Western Partnership trip, back in December of this year, and we met with 26 different people along the way. And through that and the diversity of groups that we met with, every group, when we gave them the basic idea of Riverview as a foundation, they had a different use and application for it. And that's what's exciting for us, is that we're almost setting a baseline that people can build off of. It's like setting the foundation of a house and asking your client, what kind of house do you want built? A Tudor, a ranch, a Victorian? You know, what's it going to look like to you? What's your vision of this?
So you can really go to these different environmental outlets and pitch this technology to them, and there's all kinds of applications for it.
Absolutely. The sky's the limit with it. Once we have that basic line of video footage that the camera shoots, we can manipulate it however we have to, and then we can add layers of information to it however we need to in order to tell a story. And that's the beauty of this, is the flexibility of it.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International. I'm Tommy Howe, and today we're joined by Jared Criscuolo and Christian Gustafson, the co-founders of Below the Surface and the Riverview Project. More on Below the Surface, a coast-to-coast exploration of America's waterways, can be found at belowthesurface.org. That's www.belowthesurface.org. And more on the Riverview Project can be found at riverviewproject.org, www.riverviewprojectalltogether.org. And it's also worth pointing out that Jared and Christian are also Outside Magazine's Readers of the Year for 2012, and you guys are blogging for the magazine throughout the year. What an outstanding platform to have, just as Below the Surface and the Riverview Project is really at this crucial point of growth. This is terrific.
We've always looked to the media to help us along and get the message out. You know, there's only so much we can do on our own, but there's all of these established platforms that already exist that we want to work with and use. And I think in the conservation and science and research realm, having as many advocates and voices on your side it's absolutely critical. It's just like any other campaign, political or otherwise. You know, you got to get the word out. And that was one of the pivotal things with our Gaining Ground expedition. Reader's Digest did a story, and Jared had a contact with Outside Magazine who offered to get us plugged in there.
Yeah, so basically, you know, to what Christian was saying, partnerships are key to us. The way this all happened was kind of fortuitous. One of my friends, Olin, is on the board of directors of a group here in San Diego called Outdoor Outreach. Phenomenal organization. They take kids out paddling, they take kids out surfing, they take kids hiking, snowboarding. There's all sorts of great activities where they take kids that would not otherwise have exposure to outdoor activities and get them out there doing, experiencing. So Olin's been a friend of mine for a number of years. he introduced me to one of his fellow board members, Shelby Stanger, who's a writer. She's based here in San Diego out of La Jolla. It's a phenomenal adventure. She's got just an awesome personality. She's super engaged in all sorts of crazy activities, from paddling the Amazon River to surfing. Olin introduced the two of us. We met up a couple times. She was a little hesitant at first. I think she thought we were insane. But
why did she think you were insane?
Or maybe she thought Jared was hitting on her.
I think that might have been the case. I think what it boils down to is maybe I was smiling and winking a little too much. But the long and the short of it is...
You have to be charming. That's part of it.
Well, that's,
you know?
Yeah, that's part of it. So Shelby and I were chatting and kind of told her what we were doing, what the ideas that we had were, and what the hope was for Riverview Project. And she took the bait. She wrote up an article for us, and she was looking at a few different magazines. And she said, well, how about Outside Magazine? I'll pitch it to Outside Magazine. So we bounced an idea back and forth a few times, and she sent it over to Outside Magazine. Within a couple of weeks, her editor got back to her and said, cool article, we like it, but we really like these guys for Reader of the Year. Now, this is first week of September of this past year, 2011. Mm-hmm. Within a week, they basically dumped all the other nominations that they had, and they said Jared and Christian for Reader of the Year. So we were awarded this Reader of the Year award, which is a huge honor. This is their third year doing it. We're counting ourselves amongst the ranks of a Navy SEAL who started a program to get people that are coming back from combat out into the field, out hiking, sort of exploring, enjoying. Mm-hmm. The other guy is an athlete who has MS. He's a San Diego-based guy who, despite that, still competes in triathlons, you know, distance events, swimming events, running events. I mean, the guy is just he's a phenomenal inspiration and testament to human will. And then there's us. You know, and that's where, you know, we're really proud of this. This is a great opportunity for us. We had an article in the December 2011 issue of Outside Magazine. We'll be blogging over the course of the year about the development of the Riverview Project and a project Christian's been working on called Driving Innovation through his program at Scripps. And then we've had the opportunity to write a few small articles. We'll be pitching articles to our editors over there and really just getting our message out there. Over 2 million people read Outside Magazine, so this is a really great platform for us to talk about, you know, our sponsors and how they're helping us, our work, the impact that we want to have, and just keep pushing things forward. It's a huge honor, and we're extremely grateful for it.
And the crew at Outside Magazine, we couldn't ask for more. They were one of the reasons why we kicked off this Western Partnership Tour. We wanted to go and meet with them and interface and just get some ideas. And so Jared and I left here, took off another long weekend of prepping and packing. We're tired, and, you know, we take off a little later than we thought. Got caught in some gnarly snowstorm pretty much from south of Flagstaff to the New Mexico-Arizona border. Could barely even see. Jared's kind of freaking out a little bit, and I'm like, it's all right, dude. You know, we couldn't even see the hood of the truck at a few points. And I'm from Chicago. He's from, you know, New England. We've definitely seen our fair share of snow, and this was the real deal. We kept calling the guy, one of the editors from outside had offered to let us stay at his place. And we're like, no, we're going to be a little bit later. They were having a big party and barbecue. And
they're waiting for you guys to show up.
These guys had gone duck hunting for us, and they had like full spread of duck. They had venison lasagna for us. I mean, they're all outdoorsmen, so, you know, they laid it out. All their interns are there. All the staff is there. They're drinking, partying, having a great time, waiting for the two of us to show up. And it's 2:30 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, 7:30 in the morning. We finally get out there. Everybody had
land of
home.
Enchantment.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Definitely. That we were.
Let's talk a little bit about the Driving Innovation Plan, because I just had Peter Bick, who was the director of Carbon Nation, on the show a couple of weeks ago. Carbon Nation talks about utilizing algae for fuel and energy purposes, and that's a component of Driving Innovation, correct?
Absolutely, and biofuels have been with us since day one. My Tacoma got stolen from UCSD's campus in 2008. New truck, couple surfboards in it. I was so mad about the thing. I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to get an old rig, see how it lasts, and mess around with it a little bit. And I come to find this old diesel F-250. I was reading a little bit about biodiesel and running waste vegetable oil at the time. And this was right about the same time we were getting Below the Surface incorporated and off the ground. And when I was finishing my undergrad at UCSD, I had this old truck converted to run on biodiesel and waste veggie oil. 70,000 miles later, we've still got it. It's taken us back and forth across the country just time and time again, including the Western Partnership Tour. And New Leaf Biofuels, who's here in San Diego, helped support that with biodiesel for our expedition. We definitely appreciated that. The real gist of driving innovation came from meeting with a professor named Greg Mitchell at Scripps Institution of Oceanography when I was doing my master's there. Greg and I were having a conversation. I was telling him about how I was running biodiesel in one of my trucks and waste vegetable oil, and was really interested in some of the algae biotechnology that had been coming around and I had been hearing so much about. I said, where can I get some fuel? He goes, well, if you want it from algae, you're going to have to make it. I said, okay, how do I do that? And we had a couple more conversations, and I ended up doing another independent study at Scripps, this time under Dr. Greg Mitchell and his lab with the Scripps Photobiology Group, where I was coordinating a group of students and volunteers to actually produce a usable quantity of biofuel from algae. This went on, pretty much started off the winter of 2010, gained some momentum in the spring of 2011. And then by the summer of last year, we were growing algae out in Imperial Valley, then also on campus at UCSD, harvesting the algae, drying it, extracting the oil, and then team from UCSD, the Biofuels Actions and Awareness Network group of students, mostly undergrad, actually converted that oil into biodiesel. We are now looking at several different demonstration projects throughout 2012 to set speed records and show how a motorcycle performs in off-road races using biofuel from algae, particularly biodiesel. So we imported a diesel motorcycle from Holland. We're charging away. FedEx was one of our sponsors that got it over here, and we're just getting ready to rock and roll.
Does algae burn more cleanly than some other fuels?
It's similar to conventional biodiesel right now. It's a plant oil. Basically, biodiesel is made from either peanut oil or canola oil or whatever kind of used cooking oil is out there. It is a plant oil. Algae are a plant, a photosynthetic organism. The only difference is that they're extremely efficient. They don't have roots and leaves and stems and stalks and all that. They are just pure photosynthesis. They're a powerhouse. So you can grow a lot more algae per acre than you can corn or soybeans. They have a really strong potential of being a great source of not only fuel, but animal feed and other feedstocks as well. And they don't necessarily require farmland or even fresh water to grow. You can do it out in the desert using salt water or even wastewater. But using biodiesel and biofuels to get to where we needed to go has been a core component. So it's literally driven us to explore. And you know, quite frankly, some of these trips, driving 2,000-3,000 miles or more just on one leg, when diesel's $4 or $5 a gallon is insane. So, you know, having an option to either have it for free with a sponsor like New Leaf or actually using waste cooking oil from behind a restaurant and filtering it out, you know, that got us where we needed to go.
How do you make sure you've got a supply of fuel when you're hitting the road?
The key is definitely just to bring it with. You know, filter it out ahead of time, get all the water, get all the gunk, get it all out, and then have it with. So we'll travel around with 2 or 3 55-gallon drums or various other containers of biodiesel or waste vegetable oil in the back of the truck. Just on this last trip, the truck was smoking a lot outside of Vail. It was a combination of the cold weather, the fuel we were running and everything else, and you know, just it being an older truck. We pulled off to change a fuel filter, and somebody called the fire department.
Yeah, so we're sitting there on the side of the highway. I mean, you know, like, Christian's got his ski boots on. We've taken a couple days to chill out because we've been burning pretty hot for about a week and a half at this point. He's got his ski boots on. He's hanging out of the hood of the truck. I'm hanging out of the hood of the truck. And we've got the fuel filter is installed in a fairly tight spot. So we've got a little piece of nylon webbing that we're using to try to crank this thing off. And there's smoke everywhere. Fire truck comes flying up the road, sirens on, we see lights, they jump out with oxygen tanks and their axes and the whole nine yards. I mean, they're ready to go to war on us. And the guy runs up, he goes, "This truck on fire?" We're like, "No, man, we're just changing the fuel filter." And he goes, "Oh, we had a bunch of calls that there's a truck fire on the side of the highway."
I'm glad to hear everyone made it back in one piece.
Yeah, it turned out
no charges were filed.
All's well that ends.
Not for that.
Jared and Christian, great seeing you guys. Thanks for being on the program, and good luck with everything with the Riverview Project, continuing below the surface, and all your other projects. And we hope to see you guys soon.
Thanks,
right,
Tommy. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tommy. Take care, man. Keep up the good work.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International. I'm Tommy Howe. Thanks once again to Jared Criscuolo and Christian Gustafson of Below the Surface and the Riverview Project. Again, more on Below the Surface can be found at belowthesurface.org. That's belowthesurface.org. And more on the Riverview Project can be found at riverviewproject.org. That's riverviewproject.org. For more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, go to the Tree Huggers International website at www.treehuggersintl.com. That's treehuggersintl.com. You can also access the Tree Huggers International page via the FM949 website at fm949sd.com. Also find social media outlets for Tree Huggers International at Facebook and Twitter, and our Twitter account is at treehuggersintl. Tree Huggers International content is also available on iTunes. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International. We'll be back again same time next Sunday with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wilderness, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Thanks for making us a part of your Sunday morning, and enjoy the rest of your weekend. Be well.